MacCast, Friday, May 9th, 2014. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome to the MacCast. Glad to have you back here with me on... It's a Friday for me. I'm never quite sure when you're actually listening to the show, but it's Friday here, and I've had just a podcast day today. I was on the Mac show this morning on the British Tech Network, and then we followed that up with the We Have Communicators podcast with Michael Johnston and Jeff Gamet, and now here I am talking to you on the MacCast, and we have a lot of stuff to talk about, actually. It's surprising because things have slowed down a little bit in terms of the Mac news, but we have a few things to discuss, including some new versions of the operating system. Well, WWDC right around the corner, so usually we start to hear rumors and inklings about what we're going to see there, and it's usually software-focused. So got macOS 10 and iOS 8 information for you, along with, of course, the latest in rumors, stuff regarding the iPhone and the iWatch, and also maybe some upcoming iPads. And then kind of the big story happened late in the week. Looks like Apple's going to be making one of their biggest acquisitions ever, and it's a little bit of a curious one. So we're going to get into that. I also have feedback from you. Got a lot of great feedback on my whole cutting the cord thing. Got some great comments and opinions from you. Also, some feedback on NFC outside the U.S. I had made some comments about the usage of NFC technology in the U.S., and I got some responses there. Someone's having an issue with some older printers, so we're going to get into that. And I have a really cool iOS app to talk to you about. We'll get to all of that in just a moment. But before we get started, I do want to take a quick second and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Connected Data, makers of the Transporter. Hey, do you like having cloud storage that works with your computers and mobile devices, but hate having to manage it because you have a free account and your storage is limited? Or if you've done a paid account, do you like having that monthly subscription bill draining out your bank account? I really don't. You know, we're getting more and more of these subscription services, and I'd like to get rid of some of them. And so if those things have been bothering you, you might want to take a look at getting a Transporter. You really should consider giving it a try, because what the Transporter is it's personal cloud storage. And what I mean by that is it's a simple network device. You buy it, you connect it to your home network. You don't need to connect it to your Mac. You just hook it up to your Wi-Fi or your Ethernet, and it has a built-in hard drive. You can add your own. It can come pre-configured with a 1 terabyte or a 2 terabyte drive, or you can get a bigger one, 2.5 inch hard drive. You pop it in there, and then you just install the Transporter desktop software. It walks you through setting up an account just like you would with any other cloud service, and in a matter of minutes, you now have your own personal cloud server that sits in your house, and then it just functions just like you're used to with other cloud services. You put your files on it, you can have it sync up to your Mac, to other transporters, and you have access to it over the internet from all of your devices, Macs, PCs, tablets, phones, doesn't really matter, but it's your storage on your device in your home network. And that means you don't have the monthly bill, you just buy the Transporter because you are the cloud service. And you also maintain control over all your files and data. It's not leaving your control or your possession. So also, if you worry about security, the Transporter is a great solution for that because it's not going off into some third-party cloud service out there. Plus, you get access to the entire volume. So all of the space, if you've got a 1 terabyte, you get access to the full 1 terabyte. If you have a 2 terabyte Transporter, you have full access to the 2 terabyte Transporter. Plus, they now have the Transporter Sync option, which allows you to get all the functionality of a Transporter, but you connect in your own external USB hard drive. You could have a 3 terabyte, a 4 terabyte. I'm not even sure where we're at in terms of external USB drives. I know they have 4 terabyte ones, maybe even bigger coming around the corner. But if something bigger comes out, guess what? You can expand your own storage. And they just updated their iOS app to include a new photo and video upload feature. So now all the images and videos that are on your iOS devices can automatically be uploaded to your transporter when you're connected to the same Wi-Fi network. That means no more needing to remember to connect to iPhoto to back up your camera roll. You walk into your house, boom, you can have the transporter grab all of the photos and videos right off of your device. And transporters come in 500 gigabyte, 1 terabyte, and 2 terabyte capacities. And they have that transporter sync that I mentioned. You connect your own hard drive. That starts at just $99. And best of all, you can get even more of a discount by being a MacCast listener. MacCast listeners get 10% off any transporter up to $35 off by using the code MC10 at the File Transporter Store, filetransporterstore.com, and you can get $20 off a transporter sync by using the code MC20. So MC20 for the transporter sync, MC10 for the other transporters to get 10% off. And you can see the full lineup and get your discount over at filetransporterstore.com. Plus, it's risk-free. They have a 30-day risk-free satisfaction guarantee. So you can try it for yourself, see what it's like to have cloud storage without the monthly fees, without the storage limitations. And I think you're really going to enjoy the transporter experience. And a big thank you to Transporter and Connected Data for their support of the MacCast. It's starting to look like any day now we could see an update to OS X Mavericks in software update. Apple on Tuesday seeded out the latest version of Mac OS X 10.9.3 Mavericks out to developers and testers. They're asking them to focus on the graphics drivers, audio, Safari, mail, and contacts and calendar syncing over USB and iTunes in this latest build, which was numbered 13D55. It's basically the same list of features that was in a build that Apple put out just a week ago. So when the builds start to get closer and closer together like this, it's a sure sign that we're getting close to a release. We have that as an indicator, plus the fact that Apple also provided to employees the very first seed of 10.9.4. It was codenamed Epic. So I'm not really sure if that means it's a bigger update coming in 10.9.4 than what we'll see in 10.9.3, but looking like we could expect to see a 10.9.3 update soon. And so if you've been having any kind of issues in Mavericks, maybe some of those will get patched up in the next couple days to week or so. And then looming just about a month away now, a little less than a month away actually, is Apple's Worldwide Developer Conference. WWDC 2014 is happening June 2nd through the 6th. And it is expected that Apple's latest operating systems will take center stage, and that Mac OS 10.10, there's too many 10s in there. Mac OS 10.10 is going to be a primary focus at the event, kind of taking a front seat or stepping in front of the next version of iOS. 10.10 is codenamed Syrah. And it is said to be an end-to-end redesign of the entire operating system, much like the treatment that iOS received in the move from iOS 6 to iOS 7. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean in terms of the actual visual elements, although I expect it to take some hints and cues from iOS 7, but more in terms of the scope of the treatment that Apple's going to be giving to the design. Apple has been reportedly actually allocating some of its iOS user interface resources over to the Mac OS X team in order to actually be able to finish up the design in time for WWDC. So there's usually a crunch time that happens leading up to the big announcements, Apple trying to get everything ready, and they very often will shift team members around to put focus on what they're really focusing on. So the fact that they've moved people from iOS to OS X says that that is going to be the thing that they're really, really working on, and there's expected to be some big, big updates in there. Apple is expected to maintain the differences, though, between the desktop operating system and the mobile experiences, so we're not expecting the new design to merge everything together into a single OS, and at least not yet. And then as far as what they're actually focusing on in OS 10.10, we're hearing that the Finder is still going to have its multi-window tasking, and Mission Control's still expected to stay in there, so no huge changes there. I would assume, again, that we're going to get a lot of design cues coming over from iOS 7, things like the icons and maybe the flattening of the user interface, those sorts of things. I'm curious to see to what degree Apple is going to do that. I'm expecting it to be a little more subtle than maybe what they did in iOS, but definitely I think you're going to be able to see the family resemblance when Apple shows it off at the conference. But definitely expect to see more seamless integration, I think, between Mac OS X on the desktop and your mobile devices running iOS. I really expect to see a lot tighter integration, more apps across platforms, more syncing, probably a lot more cloud, iCloud specifically integration, things like that. One thing that I'm hoping, praying that Apple includes in the desktop version of Mac OS X is AirDrop support for iOS, so that we'll finally be able to use AirDrop to transfer files between the desktop and our iOS devices. That'll finally fully decouple, I think, applications and stuff from iTunes. Does anybody actually use that iTunes feature where you can transfer files back and forth? I think most developers have found some sort of workaround to transfer files either through a cloud service or wirelessly. So it's really silly that the only way really to get apps or documents from an app into the desktop natively, you know, within Apple's sort of methodology for doing it, is still with going through iTunes. Or I guess iCloud, but, you know, through iTunes in terms of a direct connection from device to desktop. So hopefully that will change. Apple has also been reportedly trademarking a bunch of California landmark names. So we don't know what name Apple is going to give it, but we know that they switched from the Big Cats when they released Mavericks 10.9 to using locations within the state of California. So Mavericks is actually a surf spot in Northern California. Apple has reportedly trademarked names like Yosemite, Mammoth, and Diablo. So we'll have to see what name Apple gives it, but we should find out at WWDC. We should get that final name. And then there's also been rumors about what we might see in iOS 8. It is expected to take a little bit of a backseat to OS 10, probably not as many major updates and changes, but one big element that's being rumored about is the new HealthBook application. Think of a Passbook style application, but with integration for different health statistics and fitness tracking, those sorts of things. It's not really clear if Apple will tip their hand and show what they've been working on with respect to the iWatch. I would fully expect that there's going to be no kind of hardware announcement at WWDC. So if they do show off the HealthBook app, that could be a little bit surprising, although we are hearing some inklings that there may be a third-party API element, a way for third-party apps and devices and things like that to tap into the HealthBook application and integrate. So if they do that, Apple could announce maybe some partnerships with select vendors of medical devices and things like that that integrate with the HealthBook application and then bring out, you know, their integrated solution with iWatch later in the year. Another update that's expected for iOS 8 would be public transit directions. We've also been hearing that there might be a standalone version of iTunes Radio, so moving that out of the music app into its own app, something that we saw Apple do with podcasts, so that would make sense. One that I'm a little bit on the fence about, we've been hearing rumors that Apple may bring a text edit and a preview app to iOS 8. I don't think that we need standalone apps for those applications in iOS, but I guess anything is possible. And there have been some rumors that some of the keystone features of iOS 8 might actually be delayed a bit and not come out until the first update of iOS, iOS 8.1, which I guess is reportedly already kind of in development. So Apple's kind of shifting around the features, and the rumor for that is because they've had to shift some resources over to the OS X team, they might not be able to finish up everything that they want in iOS 8. And because I think iOS 8 is not expected to have as many major updates and changes, that they kind of could move things around a little bit. Apple is also said to be planning some significant changes to iCloud, and it sounds like the focus will be on making iCloud integration within apps easier and more robust for developers. that would be a huge welcome change, because I know in talking to developers, implementing iCloud features within apps and doing all that syncing and stuff like that, I think is a bit of a bear in the current way they're doing things. So anything that Apple could do to help ease that along would be really great, not only for developers, but I think great for the iCloud platform and gaining specifically more support for things like documents in the cloud. I think people still really rely on, I know I do, rely on other services like Dropbox or things like the Transporter to actually solve those problems for them, rather than relying on Apple's solution. So Apple needs to really start to make a bigger and bigger push, both I think on the desktop and in iOS for cloud, and they have to get a lot better with their cloud services and make it a viable thing for developers to want to tap into and to almost be like, why wouldn't I do it? And they're really not there yet. So they need to make those changes. Another rumor we had been hearing is that Apple might do a deal with the song identifying service Shazam that could be integrated into the operating system, specifically within Siri, so that you could ask Siri to identify a song if you were at an event or a public location and there was a song playing. You could just say, Siri, what is that song? I'm actually thinking if Apple integrates this technology, they could take it one step further and do a little more predictive detecting of any music that might be playing when you're out and about with your iOS device, and that you could simply pull up the lock screen and it would already have identified any music that might be playing nearby. I don't know if that would be something you'd turn on or off. I guess that could get a little bit annoying, but it'd be interesting to see, and I don't see why they couldn't do it. Another thing I would really hope for with regard to Siri, and I think is way overdue, is giving developers some sort of API access, some way to allow Siri to access the information within applications, third-party applications, so we can get a lot more functionality out of it. I think if you can open up Siri to developers, there's going to be a lot of big creative solutions. And I think it would go a long way to pushing Siri technology more into the mainstream. I think right now it's kind of one of those niche features that very few of us use. I am a heavy Siri user, and I'm actually relying on Siri more and more, especially now that it has better integration with things like Wolfram Alpha and the Google search. She can actually return results and it stays within the Siri interface rather than having to jump out into another application. The problem there, though, is it's only right now Apple's applications, sort of Apple's blessed applications that Siri can get data from and interact with. If that was opened up a little bit more, I think there'd be a lot more power in that Siri technology. And then also, we're expected to see some of the things that iOS 8 might be able to take advantage of in the new processor in an upcoming iPhone 6. I don't think they're going to announce the iPhone, but it's fully expected that Apple would have a new A8 processor in there, probably focused more on power efficiency, and I would imagine GPU improvements. So maybe within the operating system, we can see some of the software technologies that are going to go hand in hand with the processor technologies. Apple always does a great job of integrating the hardware and the software, so we might be able to see some software hints of what's going on over on the hardware side. But again, too, there, Apple's pretty careful about kind of picking those key features within the operating system that doesn't tip its hand too much, doesn't give away too much about what's coming in the fall with their iPhone and iPod announcements. Apple TV, let's talk about that a little bit. There were some heavy rumors that Apple might do some new Apple TV hardware at WWDC. Those seem to be cooling off a little bit. It doesn't look like we're going to see anything major on the Apple TV side. I do think we'll see maybe a few software announcements for Apple TV, some updates, those sorts of things. Tim Cook has declared it no longer a hobby, so it's more of a priority. So it might get a little more focus, a little more center stage at WWDC. But again, I think it's going to be third tier to iOS 8 and Mac OS 10. It's expected that when Apple does an Apple TV update, we might see the gaming integration support for those Bluetooth gaming controllers and maybe opening up games on the platform, some sort of gaming store. I think Apple might even take it one step further and we might finally start to get apps on the Apple TV. My personal opinion is that if we do get an app store on Apple TV, it'll be sort of an invite only thing up front, where Apple kind of handpicks select developers and applications that make sense on the Apple TV, but maybe a wider range of applications that we can pick and choose from. Right now, Apple sort of just pushes out applications to the device, and I think an app store is overdue for that platform. It's also expected that Siri might find her way onto Apple TV, so we get some voice commands and some voice control, and that if there's new hardware at some point, that there might be gesture-based controls built in there, something that maybe they leverage their PrimeSense technology for. Although I think that's going to be more one of those features, again, that it's not going to be talked about publicly in the software. Maybe that stuff will be in there for developers who are working with Apple TV, but it's going to take a hardware announcement, which, again, I would expect to happen sometime in the fall before we actually get more details and information on things like gesture control. So I say no to any kind of hardware announcements at WWDC. I think they're going to stick with history, keep it completely software-focused, really aimed at developers. I think that they may need to tip a few developers to some of the hardware things that are going on. Again, really, especially if they're wanting to bring developers in on the Apple TV product, but I think that's all going to be under NDA and really hush-hush and secret. And it'll be just, they'll kind of tap those developers that they want to partner with for a launch of new hardware in the fall. So I think at WWDC, a lot of those sort of agreements and the wheels start to get set in motion for who they're going to have up on the stage when they do their announcement and what kind of sort of keystone apps they want to show off for their new hardware features. But that's all, you know, nothing the public is going to be privy to. So that'll be going on, but no big hardware announcement at WWDC. I think it's probably fairly safe to say that Apple watchers and fans and the bloggers and sites and things like that are completely enamored and sort of caught up in iPhone 6 fever. I mean, this happens every time we're between iPhone launches, right? When the iPhone comes out, everybody's excited. They get the new model, and then the next 9 months is just speculating and wondering what the next iPhone's going to look like. It's like, you know, we're kids that want that shiny new toy, and then the minute we get it, it's kind of cast aside, and we just are ready for the next shiny new toy to come out. But that goes on, and then, of course, everybody wants to know what it looks like, so we see 3D models, and this past couple weeks has seemed to be like the weeks of mock-ups. Like, every site started posting these mock-up images, whether they're 3D printed things or just stuff that somebody slapped together in their basement. I have no idea. But the one thing that's bothering me is that a lot of these are just freaking ugly. They are just ugly. And there was one particular one that I think showed up over on Boy Genius Report. And yes, the sort of form factor in terms of the thinness, the kind of rounded edges, a lot of the things that we've been hearing about might be technically accurate based on the rumors, but in the upper third and or the upper part and lower part, I guess, you know, those parts where the camera system is and where like the home button is, and we have the little line for the antenna, that sort of little breakpoint, I guess on the current phone design, it's where the glass piece on the top is and the glass piece on the bottom is. This mock-up had just ugly, like, plastic ring around it. And the internets were just buzzing with the story and showing these pictures of this mock-up. And I'm just thinking, if this is the mock-up... Oh, it also had that little ugly camera lens bump like you have on the iPod Touch. Something that actually the latest rumors have been saying has been nixed along with the optical image stabilization feature that even Apple didn't like that thing sticking out, and they decided, you know, we'll do without the optical image stabilization so that we can have a smaller camera lens system and it doesn't have to stick out. But that model that's been making the rounds with that ugly plastic, I don't know, I'm calling it kind of the antenna ring, but imagine if you had not just the line where the antenna goes, but then this other line that went around the top edge of the phone, around the curve, around the top edge of the phone, so up over the lens system and stuff like that, and then on the bottom, same kind of thing. So where the current iPhone 5S has the glass, imagine if that was just like this little plastic strip with a piece of metal or glass in the middle of it. Ugly. Just awful. And if that's really what the thing is going to look like, then I think Johnny Ive needs to have his, you know, he needs to give back his license to design or relinquish his knighthood, or something bad needs to really, really happen. But again, what we have to remember is that these are just mock-ups. It's definitely going to be thinner. It's going to be metal and glass. It's going to be bigger. But beyond that, we really don't know. So what we're seeing when it says mock-up, and unfortunately some of the sites are actually mixing up terms, because I think Boy Genius Report and some other sources keep saying leaked mock-ups. Well, leaked implies that it's something that is either at a manufacturer or a prototype or something like that. These are two separate things. A mock-up is just somebody built this thing based on some rumors to kind of represent what they think it might actually look like. So don't put too much stock in these, and I'm definitely not, because I think they're just, most of them are really, really awful. So trying to kind of get back to some of the things that I think we do know, or some assumptions that we can make that I think make common sense. That's really the way to put this, right? These are just assumptions and speculation. We know bigger, thinner, lighter, faster. I mean, these are all the kinds of things that Apple's going to do in every iteration, but we don't know a lot of details. Most people feel that Apple's going with a 4.7-inch form factor. That seems to be the popular rumor. Also, that there may be a 5.5-inch model coming out later. And actually, late this week, we heard a little shift on the timeline. Some sites are saying that we might see the 4.7-inch in August and then the 5.5 in September. I think Apple's only going to do one model. I think the launch time frame is going to be September. I don't think we're going to get an announcement as early as August, but again, I don't put it out of the realm of possibility. My gut instinct says one iPhone size, 4.7-inch in September. But again, I, like everybody else, I'm just kind of pulling this stuff out of my hindquarters. That's really what's going on there. So you could do it too. You could pull your own wishes out of your posterior and put up a blog post, and you would be just as likely to be right as the next guy. We did hear this week that it sounds like small shipments of the Sapphire Glass have started making their way from Apple's partner in Arizona, GT Advanced Technologies, over to China. That initial shipments have been going over there to start to try and build out some of the first production models of the iPhone 6. They're running just about 100 furnaces right now, according to sources. And so if they are at that capacity, it sounds like they're shipping about $1 million worth of Sapphire Glass over to China per month. Once they move into full production, it's expected that they're going to be reaching about 50 times that, about $50 million worth of Sapphire Glass shipping. And that would mean they'd need a lot more furnaces. As a matter of fact, the rumors say that they should be up to 1,500 additional furnaces in the first half of 2014. So right about now, they should be bringing online a whole bunch more capacity to that plant. It's not clear at this point what the glass is actually going to be used for. Many are assuming that it's for panels for the iPhone 6, but it could also be for the iWatch. We do know that Apple uses the Sapphire Glass currently for the lens covers as well as the covers on the Touch ID sensors. But the fact that anything is shipping over to China in terms of parts for new devices means that Apple is getting ready to move in production, and that timeline sort of lines up. If Apple's getting ready to have products to go out in the fall, they're going to need to start ramping up production, getting parts to suppliers and things like that. And as a matter of fact, one Apple supplier, Pegatron, is reportedly getting about 15% of the orders for the next generation iPhone 6, the 4.7-inch model. In the past, Apple's partner Foxconn has been the main supplier of iPhones, but Apple likes to have its supply chain a little bit more diversified, so it sounds like Pegatron's going to be picking up some of the slack, although some sources had thought Pegatron might have received a bit more of the percentage of the next generation iPhone. But right now it's looking like about 15%, with the remaining production, 85%, being handled by Foxconn. Another supplier reportedly also getting some parts or moving into production is Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing. They are reportedly going into production on Touch ID sensors. These are expected to be sensors used in not only the next generation iPhone, the iPhone 6, but also in an upcoming iPad and iPad mini update. And that seems very plausible to me. I think Apple's going to want to implement Touch ID across all of their iOS products. So I fully expect the next generation iPads, both models, the Mini and the iPad Air, to have Touch ID. And then one little late rumor that might be good news for Apple's camera systems on iOS devices is that Apple has supposedly hired Ari Partanen away from Nokia. He is actually the engineer who was responsible or known for the camera system on Nokia's phones, the Lumia models, which have gotten rave reviews for their camera technology and just the quality of their images. So he was in the past described as Nokia's own camera expert. He's been highly, highly praised for the work that he had done over there and had helped develop the spec for their PureView technology, which helps with low light photography, something that Apple really could use some help with in the iPhone sensors. I think that's one of the areas where Apple's camera system falls down. Apple gets really rave reviews for the camera and lens system in iOS devices, but still they kind of struggle on that low light end. So hopefully the acquisition of Ari is going to help Apple in that area. And I would not expect that to be some improvements that we see in the iPhone 6, because he's just coming on board now, but maybe future models will start to incorporate some of the design ideas and the engineering talents of Mr. Partanen. IDC this past week came out with its latest numbers on tablet market share, and not surprisingly, they showed that Apple is still on top of the tablet market, but not by much. Apple's iPad accounted for 32.5% of all tablets shipped in the March quarter, according to IDC, and that beats Samsung by about 10% for the quarter, but Samsung's year-over-year growth was up 31%, while Apple's growth actually declined 16.1% in the tablet space. Now, Apple did talk about this at their last quarterly conference call, and they said a lot of the decline was actually due to high numbers from the prior year because of pent-up demand. So they had pent-up demand at the end of the year leading into the first quarter of 2013, and that's when that demand was filled. So they shipped a lot more tablets than they normally would have. So when you're trying to compare 2013 quarter to 2014 quarter, it's a little off. And Apple claimed that if you compensate for that, the actual net decline in tablet sales would only be somewhere around 3%, but still you do have a decline. Now, total tablet shipments in general for this quarter were estimated to be at about 50.4 million units, and that's up only about 3.9%. So tablet growth seems to be slowing, and they're speculating that one reason for that might be the fact that customers are opting for larger screen phones, smartphones, so that could actually be delaying some of the tablet purchases. That would be an area where you'd kind of fill in, and I'm the type of person, like, I like having a smaller phone and a tablet, but I guess many consumers think that if they just have a larger screen phone, that can kind of get them by, and they can delay a separate tablet purchase. And that, I would imagine that could be one reason why we're hearing Apple is finally actually ready to go into the bigger screen phone market to kind of balance that sort of consumer demand between the two different kinds of products. Another thing about the numbers from IDC, and something you should keep in mind, is that historically IDC plays the numbers game a lot in terms of the classification and how they count numbers, and also the fact that Apple's numbers compared to the rest of the industry are quite a bit different. Apple Insider actually does a pretty good job of explaining all of this. They have a really in-depth article kind of running through these numbers. I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. But what's going on is they've kind of changed actually how they count the figures for tablet sales and the different classifications on what a tablet is year over year. So what they'll do is they'll have one definition last year, and then if they have a new definition this year, they will rejigger the numbers for both years when doing the comparison. So you really don't kind of know what's going on. Another thing that you have to remember is that they count shipments, and for Apple, their shipments and sales are the same numbers, but the same isn't true for their competitors. What Samsung ships is different than what actually gets sold through. So if you're just looking at shipment numbers, you're not actually really sure how many they really sold. So there could be a bunch of tablets sitting in different warehouses, sitting in retail stores, things like that. And Tim Cook did aptly point out that actually for Apple, the iPad is their fastest growing product ever. So the reality is that Apple's tablet business really is still growing, maybe not as at as big a rate year over year as they have been, but total tablet shipments are still way, way up year to year to year. So they keep increasing, and Apple is selling a lot of tablets. So I think the end result is we really don't have to worry about Apple's tablet sales, and we definitely don't have to worry about the margins that they're earning on tablets. Because once again, just like with the iPhone, they're not playing in that low-end tablet space. They make good margins and good profits, and that was definitely emphasized by the profit and revenue numbers that they posted in that last quarterly results call. So even though year over year iPad sales declined 16.1%, I don't think we have to worry about Apple and their sort of place in the tablet market. And I also don't think we have to worry about Apple in terms of where they're going with new products. Tim Cook basically came forward and said they're working on some of the best stuff they've ever been working on, and he's really excited to bring out new products later in the year. Most of us feel that one of those new products is going to be some sort of wearable. The media has kind of dubbed it the iWatch, and of course, we've been talking about that over the last couple months. I want to get into a little bit of the latest rumors, but not so much the rumors as sort of theory that seems to be speculating or forming, not only in my mind, but I think also in the minds of a lot of others. And that feeling, at least to me, is that calling it an iWatch is really, really underselling what Apple is up to. I think more and more we're seeing stories that indicate that Apple's entry into this market is going to be much, much bigger. It's really what Apple does. They go in and they either create new products and new demand, or they disrupt an existing ecosystem and kind of build up demand. And so this is going to be way more than a smartwatch. And I know I've brought this up before, but I want to just sort of codify or codify it a little bit more. And if you just look at, I think, the acquisitions and hires that Apple has been making, they've been hiring experts and leaders in all kinds of areas of the health and fitness industry, also in terms of technology, some of the sensor industries. You've got the sports apparel industry, the fashion industry, and you start kind of linking all those things together and going, what can they be up to? And I think it's going to be something really, really big in the realm of health, fitness, medical, you know, coupled into some sort of wearable device. And device is really too small of a word. What we're really talking about here is some sort of new platform. So the stories are shifting to say that Apple is building this platform around wearables, and that could be a watch, it could be a fitness band, it could be some other thing, but it's going to be a platform, I think, similar to what they did with iTunes and the iPod. You've got hardware and software system all coming together to create an entire kind of ecosystem around a bunch of different products, and there's going to be players, I think, outside of Apple. So I think what Apple is going to do is they're going to have some sort of integrated core hardware and software platform that's going to have a really broad consumer appeal. And then they're going to have an ecosystem built up where there's more specialized applications, maybe even more specialized devices, hardware, accessories. Again, think like the iPod. We saw all kinds of accessories, speaker systems, things that weren't developed by Apple that plugged into that core ecosystem. And the more I hear, the more I think about it, I think this makes a lot of sense. It's in many ways similar also to the iPhone and the iPod Touch, where you have an app or an accessory ecosystem supporting that core device and the cornerstone apps that Apple actually develops themselves. And that's why I think we heard a little bit about that HealthBook application maybe opening, or yeah, HealthBook application maybe being opened up so that other third parties could tap into it. I would imagine if you've seen kind of the mock-ups of what people think the HealthBook interface is going to look like, they think it's really going to look a lot like Passbook, where you kind of have these different cards, and each one of the different cards kind of represents a different health monitoring system or some sort of tracking thing. So if you're tracking your calories, you'd have a calorie count card, and you'd have a weight card, and you'd have a heart rate card, and you have your steps card and stuff like that. There's no reason why you couldn't have a third-party app or a third-party hardware device that might track via more specialized sensor, say a glucose sensor or something like that, that could have its own card that slides and integrates right into Apple's application. So you have one centralized place, one sort of centralized hub for this entire platform, and you can even have a store built into that. So if you need to buy other more specialized applications or cards or monitoring software, things like that, that would be plugged right into it. And there could even be, I think, potential integration yet at an even more sort of enterprise level with hospitals and medical device companies and things like that that are even more highly specialized. So if you have an app, this Apple wearable device, and you need to go in for treatment or something like that, they could tie that into the hospital system to do monitoring and help nurses better monitor and see what's going on with your health and your vitals and things like that. So all of this makes much more sense, especially given the data we saw from a recent question and answer session that was done with current smartwatch owners by the website Fixya. Basically, they were looking at, you know, what do people want in a smartwatch? What do they like about their smartwatches that are out now? So they were looking at things like the Pebble and the Galaxy Gear and all those sorts of things. And, you know, what do they want? And in general, people were pretty unimpressed with the whole watch concept. They really just saw it as this extension of their smartphone and not really as a standalone device. And I think Apple really wants to do something that functions as a full device, standalone product, like I said, an entire kind of ecosystem. They also commented that, you know, the smartwatches were kind of unreliable in terms of the things that they did do. So, like, the notification systems didn't work all that well. They had poor speakers and voice control. They had small screens, so voice control made more sense for the device, but it really didn't work. So you didn't have a good screen. Battery life was an issue. They didn't last all day. Poor quality of the display and size of the display was a problem. So it really doesn't look like, you know, if we're talking about Apple doing a watch, a smartwatch, a iWatch, that doesn't just seem to make sense because they don't have a broad consumer appeal. They're not really doing a lot. They aren't going to help Apple build a platform that they can sell services and software and accessories and other things into. So I think we're looking at something much, much bigger. And I'm actually even starting to think now it'll be interesting to see if we see an announcement from Apple in this realm in the fall, because this is a big undertaking. And it's probably why we're seeing it take longer than some analysts and industry watchers would really like to see. But Apple is going to take the time to make sure they get this right. And again, I think if you go back to the acquisitions and see what they've been doing in terms of hires and stuff like that, they're definitely putting a big stake into this. And it's going to be the next, I think, big market that they're going to try to disrupt. I know a lot of people would like to see them do more in the television space, but I think they've kind of set that aside for now, maybe because some of the obstacles that they've run into in terms of licensing and content. And I think they're really focusing on this whole health services, wearables kind of market for now. And it's going to be really interesting to see what they actually put out as a product. And I'm hoping and expect that, I do expect that we'll see something from Apple in the fall. But it's interesting, I just wanted to point out, it's interesting if you're watching the stories to kind of look at all this stuff and trying to kind of connect the dots, right? That's what we try to do. So rather than just kind of speculating and making stuff up, look logically at what Apple is doing and what they've been buying and acquiring. And I think you can get a good sense for what they might be up to. There was some good news this week for any of you who are concerned about privacy and your data, at least with respect to how Apple is going to handle that information if they are required to provide that information to government agencies or law enforcement. Apple posted on their website new data request guidelines that specifically spell out how law enforcement needs to request that data, and it will require a subpoena or some other greater legal process. Apple's page also outlined what kind of information they could get with the various types of requests. One of the biggest things that I noticed was that when they can, Apple said they would start notifying customers when it received a law enforcement data request. So in some cases, you would actually know if a law enforcement agent had requested access to your information. The key part here, though, is Apple said they would do that when they can. sometimes the court order could actually block Apple from making that notification. There's also some situations where Apple may choose, they said, at their discretion, not to notify the individual. That would be in cases where injury or death to an identifiable individual might be a risk, or a group of individuals. And also, they said they would not notify in situations where the case relates to child endangerment. So obviously, they don't want to do anything through the notification that would cause harm to some other individual. And that makes common sense to me. But another interesting thing about the pages is it did talk about the technology limits that Apple had on the data and kind of spelled out, here's the data that we can give out. Here's the kinds of data that we can't give out. Some of the things that they can give out, SMS messages, photos, videos, contacts, audio recordings, call history, and they can get all of that stuff even if you have a device that's passcode locked. But if you use a passcode on your device, they would not be able to provide things like email, your calendar entries, or any data from third-party applications. So I would assume the difference there is some of that information is encrypted when your passcode locked. Some of that information probably is not encrypted, even if you have the passcode lock turned on. They also talked about some of the information agencies could get from your Apple ID, things like your iTunes and App Store purchase records, customer service records, your retail and online store purchase history, also any kind of visits you've had to the Genius Bar, repairs, those sorts of things. That's all accessible and available. The Apple ID also could include things like your customer name, contact records, iTunes gift cards that you've purchased, things like that. That all kind of jived and made sense to me as I was kind of reading through it. They addressed iCloud a little bit. Some of the iCloud data that is available includes things like backups, your connection logs, any kind of IP addresses. I would assume those are IP addresses that you might be connecting from, which could be tracked back to locations. Also, any iCloud mail logs for the past 60 days. I think that's not your emails per se. That is just, you know, how you accessed the mail system, when and where, those sorts of things. And then they talked a little bit about the Find My iPhone feature. If you've enabled Find My iPhone, they would be able to track location, things like that. But if you had not enabled Find My iPhone on your device, Apple has no way to remotely enable that on a device. So they can't reach out, turn it on, and then track your location themselves. It actually has to be on prior to actually receiving that information request. They also spelled out for law enforcement agencies how they would be willing to do data extraction. They said that any kind of data extraction does need to be performed on the premise at Apple's campus, and that devices used for extraction would have to be in good working order. And then they talked a little bit about wiretapping. They said if they were served with a federal wiretap order, that Apple would be able to intercept users' email communications, but that they could not get at any of your iMessage or FaceTime communications because those are actually encrypted. So I guess if you're doing nefarious things, you want to stick to iMessage or FaceTime audio, as they're not going to be able to eavesdrop or tap into that information. But, I mean, kudos to Apple for trying to be a lot more transparent about how they're handling that data. And, you know, really, I really applaud them for doing the notification thing when they can, because, you know, you don't want this kind of stuff necessarily going on in secret without your knowledge. If you're being investigated, you should be aware of it and notified of it, and know that, hey, agencies are after and getting at this information. And then talk about burying the lead this week. Our last story is actually probably the biggest story of this week. It actually broke really, really late. And it's the Financial Times reporting that Apple is in late-stage negotiations to acquire Beats by Dre. That's the headphone company that was started by rapper Dr. Dre, and both Bloomberg and the Wall Street Journal have confirmed the report through their sources. It's expected that we could hear an announcement of a deal maybe as early as next week. And according to the report, Apple is offering $3.2 billion for the company. That's billion with a B. And in case you're wondering, yes, that is a crazy big number. It's not only more than Apple has ever spent to acquire any other company, but according to one report that I read, it's more than the known amounts of all the money Apple has spent on acquisitions since the founding of the company. So it's a big bill for headphone hardware company, and it would be the company's largest acquisition to date since the purchase of Next in 1996, which they only paid $400 million for. So that seems like a bargain compared to the whole Beats deal. And of course, the question then becomes, why would Apple pay so much money for a high-end consumer accessory company, and especially one that some people actually even call into question whether or not they're high-end or not? They're definitely high-priced headphones, and is it even something that kind of fits with Apple's ecosystem? One thing that Beats does have going for it, I guess, is it does have a pretty strong brand. It's pretty popular, especially among a younger audience, and that's one area where I think Apple is really trying to get some market share back, that whole teen, young adult demographic. Apple definitely wants to appeal to it, but I don't know if they have been as of late. So that could be one possible reason. Also, just the fact that it's a higher end, a premium, or perceived as a premium brand that particularly fits maybe with Apple's model. I talked about this on a couple shows, that if you go into Apple's retail stores and look at over the ear headphones, which is really what Beats kind of specializes in, that you really won't find headphones under about $130. And I think most of their headphones are over $200. So it kind of fits in there. But I'm not really sure you pay $3.2 billion for just a headphone accessory company. But that's not the only part of the Beats business. Another thing that they launched recently was Beats Music, which is a streaming music service, a la Spotify or RDO. But they have kind of a unique angle, which is they have playlists that are created by musicians and music writers. And the secret sauce is said to be that they have a really, really good editorial team that's really good at making music recommendations. And actually, fans of the service say it's one of the best music recommendations systems and services of any of the streaming music services that are out there. So it could be that whole streaming music business, but you start to look at that and, you know, Apple has its own streaming service in iTunes Radio. And despite the fact that the press and the media like to say that it's not doing that well, it still is the number three streaming radio service behind Pandora and Spotify. And if you look at Beats Music, Beats Music has not been doing that well either, is not been reported to be doing that well. It's estimated that maybe it has around 200,000 users. So this definitely isn't a sort of customer acquisition. If Apple buys Beats Music, they're not gaining a bunch of new sort of subscribers. They could be gaining some talented software engineers. Maybe it's the software and hardware that they're after. Maybe it's the infrastructure. But again, I keep coming back to that $3.2 billion number, and it just doesn't seem to add up to me. So a lot of people are kind of scratching their heads on why Apple might be moving forward with this. And as far as the recommendation side of things goes, Apple does, in its iTunes Radio service, already do kind of featured artist playlists and recommendations, things like that. Maybe not to the degree that Beats is, but I think another potential reason Apple might try to acquire them that's being thrown around is, you know, that they just want to get up and running with a streaming, a true streaming music service. So on-demand streaming versus just the whole radio model, and Beats would bring that with them. But you look at something like the licensing for all of that, all the licensing deals that need to be put in place with the music industry, and that would not, it's my understanding, that would not transfer in an acquisition. So Apple would still have to go back and renegotiate. So then I come back and I'm thinking, well, at least they're going to have people on staff at Beats Music, the employees who have been doing those deals. They have a lot tighter industry connections within that company than maybe Apple does. But even then, Jeff Gamet pointed out in the We Have Communicators episode that the industry is still going to know that once Apple acquires the company, they're now dealing with Apple. They're not dealing with a bunch of just music industry media insiders, right? So that might not even be something that Apple can leverage. So we have all these little things that might be potential advantages, potential benefits, but even in aggregate, it's not all sort of piling up. But then just hours after the sort of Beats acquisition story broke, the New York Post started reporting that the Beats CEO Jimmy Iovine is in talks to join Apple as a special advisor to Tim Cook on creative matters. And Iovine is a big music industry insider. As a matter of fact, he's the chairman of Universal Music Group's Interscope, Geffen, A&M music labels. But his contract is actually set to expire at the end of this year. He also worked on music stuff at Apple with Steve Jobs back in the iPod days in 2002 and 2003, and was trying even back then to kind of push Jobs into creating a subscription music service. So Iovine, with or without Beats, could really be a good ally for Apple because of his deep ties into the music industry and also, I think, experience with wanting to do a subscription music service and having started one up at Beats. So you throw him into the mix and maybe there's something there. They're going to acquire the company, keep him on as a special advisor. That kind of makes sense. Some people have thrown out that maybe Apple wants that Beats brand, again, to kind of gain more relevancy in that younger demographic because it is a strong brand. But Apple typically doesn't keep brands that they acquire, right? They're absorbed into the Apple culture and the Apple ecosystem. So I can't see Apple bringing on Beats and operating that as a separate company or a separate brand. So who really knows what's going on there? But we're going to have to stay tuned. And we'll find out next week if this actually comes to be. And I will probably never know the actual true number. You know, like I said, Apple doesn't talk about what it spends on acquisitions, things like that. It is just rumored at this point that it's $3.2 billion. So could be more, could be less. Maybe it's dead on. Who really knows? And I guess I have really one more little story somewhat related to this. Apple did make another acquisition this week, or it came to light that they had acquired another company. They acquired the LCD company LuxView. LuxView actually makes low-power micro LED displays, and that's a technology that Apple could incorporate into their products to build more energy-efficient and better LCDs in the future. It's not really known what Apple paid for the company, but they did recently acquire a $43 million round of venture funding, so certainly more than probably $43 million. The company holds patents for different kinds of LCD displays with brighter pictures and lower battery consumption, obviously something that Apple's products could benefit from. And as a matter of fact, micro LCDs specifically have applications in small LCD screens, so could be something that would be incorporated into the work that Apple is working on for wearable products. As a matter of fact, I think some of the technology that LuxView had was either looked at or was going to be integrated into some of Google's Glass stuff. And just as I was reading the report, I thought about the fact that this also could be the kind of thing where Apple wants to bring on talented individuals in the area of LCD and LED design, things like that. So it could be just like they did with their processors, that they're looking to put together a team that can at least design future LCD kinds of displays. Even if they don't end up producing them themselves in-house, they could pass off designs to manufacturing partners and really push the technology forward from in-house. They can kind of meet their design needs for future products and then find manufacturing partners to actually create the parts that they need for future products. So there's probably some of that going on there too. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank another one of my show sponsors, and that is Gazelle. If you've been considering upgrading your old device, maybe an old iPhone or an old iPad, maybe you want to move from an original iPad to an iPad mini, something like that, or you're looking to maybe buy a new iPhone 5C, 5S, you should check out Gazelle for selling your old device and getting a little cash to help fund your purchase. And there are lots of options for selling your old devices, but the one reason I like Gazelle so much is that they make the whole process easy and pain-free, also hassle and risk-free, something that I really, really like. All you have to do is go to gazelle.com, G-A-Z-E-L-L-E.com, and you just click. You click what kind of device you have. Maybe it's a Samsung device or an iPhone. Then you click which model, what your carrier is, answer a few simple questions about condition, and then right there, they give you a quote for your device. They'll tell you how much they'll give you for it, and you can accept their offer, and if you do, they give you free shipping, and in some cases will even provide a box to send in your old product. And they'll even buy broken devices. So even if you have an old broken device, go on gazelle.com, see what they will give you for it. And then once you box it up and send it in, they receive it, they check it out, and you get paid fast. You can get paid by PayPal, by check, or by Amazon gift card. And I like the Amazon gift card option because they give you 5% extra on your offer. So it's a really great service. If you haven't used it before, if you haven't tried it out, I really encourage you to check it out. The payments are fast, typically within a few days of your item being received, and they'll handle doing things like even wiping off the old data off the device so you know that that is going to be taken care of. And they've paid out over $100 million to over 600,000 customers. So they've been around, they've been doing this for a long time. They do a great job of it. Go to gazelle.com today and get your offer, and do it now because the longer you wait, the values fluctuate and they go down over time. So you want to do it sooner than later. Gazelle.com, G-A-Z-E-L-L-E.com. And a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. Last time on the show, I had a question about whether or not I thought we were in a place where we could actually truly cut the cord in terms of our entertainment. In other words, not have any kind of cable or television service and supplement just with the things that are available to us, either through apps on our iOS devices like Hulu and Netflix, or services through Apple TV or Roku or some of these other devices and products. And I think at the end of all of it, I kind of came to the conclusion, at least for me, that we weren't 100% there. In a lot of ways, I had mentioned I've already cut the cord. I am watching, I don't think I've ever watched any cable broadcast TV in the past probably couple years. I do almost everything through pre-recorded stuff or stuff that I buy on iTunes. In other words, DVR'd stuff or stuff that I buy on iTunes or through streaming services, specifically Netflix. But there's still certain kinds of content, sports and news and things like that, certain pieces that you still need to have cable for. And also, even with some of the services that you can get on your set-top boxes, you still have to have that connection to cable TV. And the fact that everything is so fragmented, I think, just makes it too difficult for a majority of consumers. And so we talked about that, and I got a lot of great feedback from you about the hassles and the fragmentation. And most of you agreed with me that really we're not at a point where the majority of folks can cut the cords. But then there were some of you that said, you know what, I've cut the cord and I don't have cable TV service. I don't pay for that and I haven't for a few years. And here's a couple different ways that I'm doing it. And one that particularly interested me was Kirk sent me an email, and he's been using an over-the-air DVR product called DVR Plus from Channel Master. It uses a programming guide from a service called Rovi, and so it basically works like a TiVo, but can pick up, you know, your over-the-air channels if you're in an area that can do that. And he pointed out that I did mention in the last episode that, you know, some people can get by with like an HD antenna to get HD TV channels over the air. And depending upon where, in, we didn't talk about this, but, you know, depending upon where you live, you can get a large number of channels. I think Kirk mentioned where he lived, he could get almost 20 channels over the air, but he does have to use one of those old style antennas mounted on the chimney. A lot of people think you need to have like a dedicated special HD antenna. That isn't true, and I hope I didn't give that sort of impression. By HD antenna, I just meant that you have to have some sort of antenna, usually on the outside of your house, to pick up any kind of stations. Again, depending upon what area and region you live in, I know some people can use the indoor ones. For me, I know here in San Diego, where I live, I'm actually pretty far away from where the actual transmitters are for the over-the-air stuff. So I've been told, and I haven't tested this out, I've been told when I went into Radio Shack to look into getting an antenna system that unless I get a large antenna mounted on my roof, I'm really not going to be able to pick up any stations just because of the geography and the terrain. Results are going to vary in your region. So if you're lucky enough to live in a region where you can get a large number of over-the-air channels, it looks like you might want to look into an over-the-air DVR solution. And I didn't even know such a thing exists. So the Channel Master one looks pretty good. It had pretty good ratings on CNET, and it's endorsed by Kirk, one of our listeners. So just wanted to mention that in case it might be something you want to look into to further your path toward actually cutting the cord, if that's what you're looking to do. And then another thing that I mentioned in that episode was that I still have my movie content kind of fragmented, because I spent this past year or so converting my entire DVD collection onto my Mac. I'm using Plex to consume that content, but I've also put that same content into iTunes, because with my Apple TV, I just find it easier to have it all in one place. And I've been purchasing more and more content through iTunes, be it TV content or movie content. So I like having it kind of all in one place, and I can't move my purchased content from iTunes into Plex because it's got Apple's DRM technology, digital rights management, or like I like to call it, digital restriction management technology in it. And Darren emailed to say he's actually has a solution for that. He found a piece of software, and a couple of people have told me about this app before, and I've held off on mentioning it. I'm going to tell you why here in a second, but there's an app called NoteBurner, and it will remove the DRM, the copy protection, from iTunes purchased content. And I really haven't mentioned this software before because, one, it's kind of in one of those gray areas. Let's just call it that, right? It is technically illegal to be removing the digital restrictions management, the DRM technology, from those files. And so even the software itself, I'm sometimes leery because I worry about what might be going on under the hood. I think this software is totally fine. Let me caveat that, because I even downloaded and I tried the trial, and I'm going to tell you that the second part of this is why I'm hesitant about recommending it, but I want to mention it just so people are aware, because before anybody even told me about it, I thought it was impossible to remove the DRM from your iTunes content. So depending on the laws in your region, it might be illegal to do. That's first and foremost. I'm sure it's a violation of the iTunes license agreement that you agree to when you install iTunes, or when you agree to make purchases through iTunes. But then the software itself, I tried it and I had less than stellar results. And granted, I was just using the trial, which was restricted to only being able to do 1 minute of video. And I had lots of bumps in the road. It was really tricky to actually even get it working for me. At first, I got a bunch of errors, and I was able to convert one video, but it was completely black. There was no video in it after the conversion. And what I discovered was I actually have a secondary HP monitor that I use, and it doesn't have support for the HDCP, the High Bandwidth Digital Content Protection technology that Apple requires with iTunes. So if I actually try and play video in iTunes and it's on that screen, I get that message that says, you can't play this on the screen because it doesn't support digital content protection, the High Band HDCP. So once I disconnected that monitor completely, then I was able to actually get the NoteBurner software to actually create a video without the DRM in it. But I think the way it works, and I think the way a lot of these things work, is it actually opens up, authorizes through iTunes, because what happens is when you run the software, iTunes has to be completely closed. When you start the conversion process, iTunes will open up. I think it authorizes that video to play. And then what I think it does is it actually starts playing it either in iTunes or in QuickTime. But then they hijack the video stream and then capture that video stream that's been already authorized to playback, decrypted, and then they pick it up. You won't see anything on your screen, but because they do that, the whole conversion process is a little bit slow. It's not super fast, although it did seem faster than one-to-one. I always thought it would be just like playing the movie and recording it, like we had to do in the old days with tapes or something like that, you know, when you went from one tape to another. So one for one, you know, if it was a two-hour movie, it'd take 2 hours to convert. But I emailed some back and forth with Darren. He said it takes about 30, 40 minutes to do a typical movie through the NoteBurner software. And for me, it varied each time. So sometimes the conversion would go really fast with the trial, and I'd get my minute of video after a couple minutes. Sometimes it took a really long time. And the quality did seem really good, at least in terms of the video. So they have different presets and settings. I set it up for Apple TV 2 quality, and it did create basically a good quality 720p video file without the DRM in it. But even that, once I was able to get all that, and it took me, you know, probably 30, 40 minutes just to figure out the whole process and get it working. Even after that, there was audio bugs. The audio, there were kind of clicks and pops, and it did not sound good at all. And again, I emailed back with Darren, and he confirmed that with the latest version of the software, I guess, that broke, and he emailed the developers. We haven't heard back yet to find out what's going on there. Hopefully, it's just a bug that will be fixed, but that just kind of proves my point about all this software, is that it's really kind of kludgy, and the way it works can be a little bit fiddly and tricky, and the results can be, you know, either good or bad, and you spend a lot of time doing this stuff. So for me, it just all comes down to, you know, it's really a lot of hassle. And so, like I said in that last episode, I'm kind of more happy to be the kind of person where I'll just play within the sandbox. I'll just live within Apple's little rules that are set up and inside the ecosystem, and then it just works, and I'm really happy, and I don't really have to worry about it. And the DRM is annoying, I think I've mentioned, you know, because I can't do things, obviously, you can't do things like you could with DVDs or Blu-rays, where you can lend them out to friends. Hey, you should check out this movie, it's really cool. That's taken out of the equation. And you have to kind of deal with the formats and the files and stuff like that. But, you know, since I have iPads, since I have iPhones, since I have Apple TVs, and I'm all within that sandbox, it all just works. So that's okay. And I guess I'll continue to live with that until hopefully Apple reaches the kind of agreement that they did with, like, the music industry, where they realize this is stupid. We don't need copy protection on this stuff. It's really just impacting and hassling our customers, our paying customers, and they don't like it. And we're really not protecting anything. I don't know if they'll ever get there. Hopefully they will someday. And we can then re-download all of our content without the DRM. But until then, I'm going to stick with that. But if you really want to try it out, NoteBurner is out there. And thanks, Darren, for pointing that out to us. Because again, I didn't know it was even possible. Another thing that came up on the last episode was, I think we were talking about the iPhone 6 and some of the rumors surrounding it, and it had popped up again that some feel the iPhone 6 is going to bring NFC technology for some sort of Apple payment system, or for the ability to use your iPhone with maybe existing payment systems. And I've commented several times that here in the U.S., we have NFC. I have chips in my credit cards, and we have the little chips at retail locations, but I'm always, every time I mention wanting to use it, the retailer, the person at the cash register says, oh, it doesn't work, or we don't use that, or it's wholly unsupported. So I've just never been a big fan of the NFC technology, because it's great, we have it, but if you can't use it, what's the point? Well, Andrew wrote in, and I kind of knew that in other countries, NFC was kind of a bigger deal. And Andrew wrote in, he's in Australia, and he said, you know, here we have it, it's called PayPass or PayWave, which, as a matter of fact, is what we have on our terminals here as well. It's the PayPass, and I have the little PayPass logo on my credit card. But unlike in the States, in Australia, he says it's used everywhere. And he said supermarkets, department stores, technology suppliers, fast food chains. I think I did actually use mine once at a McDonald's, and it did work. But he said even mom and pop shops, hardware stores, taxi cabs, all of that stuff. And I think over in the UK, I don't know if it's exactly the same. They have something called chip and pin, where I think it reads the chip. I don't know if it does it wirelessly or if it's actually by contact. But then you have to enter a pin number rather than doing the swipe and sign, which is, I think, what they call what we do here, you know, sort of that old style. And I'm sure that happens elsewhere as well. But can you tell I don't get out of the United States much? Yeah. Well, that's going to change. We're going to go to the UK in 2017. So those of you over in the UK, we're saving up. We're going to come over. We're going to invade. But that's a few years off now. Anyway, getting back to this whole NFC thing, it actually came out this week that in the U.S., MasterCard and Visa are wanting to get rid of the whole swipe and sign thing. So things may have changed a little bit. They're reportedly setting a deadline of October 2015 to have their systems actually changed over to a system. But it looks like it's the system where you actually insert the card into a little slot, and then it reads the little chip, and then you enter a PIN number. So I don't know if that's still technically NFC, And I don't doubt the convenience and the little bit of extra security that like chip and pin or NFC plus pin might bring. But to be clear, I still don't think that Apple is going to integrate NFC payment NFC payment system into the iPhone, because I think they're going to have their own touchless payment system, not based on the current any of the kind of current NFC technology. And I guess I got a little thoughtful, or I've been thinking a little bit about that term NFC, because I think it just stands for near field communication. Which would just mean anything that wirelessly connects. But in general, I think it's kind of a, like a proprietary technology that the payment system terminals use. And it's like a little probably dedicated Wi-Fi. You know, it's not a standard technology because it has its own encryption and all that stuff for security. I'm thinking, though, that Apple is going to use some sort of combination of low-energy Bluetooth, iBeacons, plus Touch ID and not a PIN for authentication. So rather than having to enter in a PIN, you'll just scan your fingerprint on your iPhone with Touch ID, and it will recognize what store you're at and connect with the payment system over low-energy Bluetooth or some sort of more standardized technology like that. And then it wouldn't be tied to your credit card, right? You wouldn't just charge your credit card or pull the money out of your bank. It would actually be linked into your iTunes account. So not run directly through the credit card companies. And so that's the kind of system I'm envisioning Apple implementing. And I don't think it just does not require a standard NFC chip. Now, that being said, and now knowing that retailers in the US, MasterCard and Visa, want to switch over to this system, I could see that maybe Apple has it in there for supporting those payment systems, just so we don't have to have another, we don't have to carry our wallets around, right? So it could just be kind of a bonus thing. Apple could do their own thing, because I would imagine too, there's going to be some retailers that are not going to sign on for Apple's system. So NFC may still find its way into future iPhones, but I think Apple's going to try their own payment system. And another listener pointed out to me that it's very possible that the Broadcom chipsets Apple already uses for low energy Bluetooth and for Wi-Fi could have NFC technology just baked into them. If they don't already, it might be at some point, because they're trying to go to single consolidated chips for all the wireless communications within these devices. It simplifies it, allows them to make the devices smaller and stuff like that. So if there's already an NFC chip in there that supports the kinds of payment systems that maybe Visa and MasterCard are going to, it would be easy enough for it just to be enabled at some point in an iOS device and support that kind of system. So if we get it that way, I could see it happening. I'm just saying that I don't think Apple's going to put any money into trying to develop or support an NFC payment system from any of the major credit card processors. If that's what people are holding out for, I just don't see it happening. So I just wanted to kind of clarify that and add some of the additional information that some of you sent in, which was great. Thank you for all of your feedback, and a great topic. And I'm sure it's going to keep coming up, and we're just gonna have to wait and see what Apple does on the payment front. As you likely know, and as we've talked about a lot on the MacCast, when Apple does major upgrades to the operating system, so when we go from Leopard to Snow Leopard to Mavericks, one of the things we always talk about double-checking is support for old peripherals, old printers, scanners, all those devices that we connect to our Macs. And especially in business, there can tend to be like a lot of really highly specialized devices and printers and things like that. And they'll break, and hopefully the companies and manufacturers that make those devices bring out and support the new operating system with new drivers and stuff like that. But that doesn't necessarily always happen. I will say with OS X Mavericks and the more recent operating systems, at least for me, it's seemed to have been less and less of an issue. Maybe it's because I'm just personally using less and less older devices. I'm just kind of buying new printers and scanners and things like that. So maybe I'm solving the problem in a different way. But I know people that run into issues from time to time. And actually, Tim ran into a little bit of a problem, and he sent me this voicemail.
Hey, Adam, wanted to get your thoughts on a drawback of the new upgrade cycle that Apple is on with Mac OS and iOS. Especially with Mac OS, the new yearly upgrade cycle has been fun for us that like new features and the feeling that we can now get something new every year, and now for free, by upgrading the OS. That's a good thing. But the downside of this comes from the control that Apple exerts over equipment manufacturers. At least that's what I'm told by the manufacturer of the duplicator printer we use in our office. From what I understand and what they tell me, Apple writes their own printer drivers. I don't know if this is true or not, but that's what they're telling me. And manufacturers have to submit their requests to Apple, then wait for Apple to respond with updated drivers. Now, as you can see, that's obviously a problem. I mean, if Apple were more like Microsoft with updates to the OS every 7 or 8 years, then it might not be such a problem. But now that the Mac OS is being updated every year, it's a big problem. This came up because our printer, Rizzo Duplicator, doesn't have any drivers for Mavericks. There's a driver for Mountain Lion, but when I try to install the driver in Mavericks, I get a message that says this driver is not supported in this operating system. So I'm kind of stuck. So because of the accelerated upgrade cycle and the lack of available driver updates, I have to be very careful which Macs I update to Mavericks. It also keeps me from buying any new Macs because I know I'm going to be stuck as far as the drivers go. If you have any solutions, I'd love to hear them. I'd love to know if that's really the case, that Apple kind of has control over the drivers, because this is a real problem. Since they're updating every year, it's almost like the manufacturers can't keep up with the cycle that Apple's on. And if Apple has been talked about having a certain number of developers that are working on either iOS primarily or macOS primarily, they may not be looking as much at the driver side of it. So anyway, I'd love to hear your feedback on this. Thanks for the show, Adam. Been a loyal listener since early 2005, and I shall remain so. Thanks a lot.
Hey, Tim, thank you so much for continuing to listen. 2005, thanks. That's a long time. We've been doing this show for a long time, I guess, and thanks for hanging in there with me, and glad you're enjoying it. But to address your question or your concerns, I think they may be misinterpreting, or at least a support person may be misunderstanding what's going on. It was not my understanding that Apple is writing all of the drivers for all of the equipment. I mean, that would be insane. That would be impossible. I think the one thing that they are doing, and I think it's part of the new sandboxing system, or sandboxing requirements of the operating system, is I think they are requiring that manufacturers submit any new driver updates to Apple, and Apple pushes them out through the software update mechanism that's built into Mac OS X. So I know, like, if you need drivers for any of your printers, those get pulled down through the operating system. The operating system will check and see what printers you have connected to your network or to your Mac, and then pull down the appropriate drivers. So it might be that they don't want to go through the submission and certification process, maybe, that Apple requires them to go through. And that is, I mean, granted, that is a bit of a hassle rather than being able to just hand you over, say, a driver installer. But I'm not even sure that's going on. I would think that as long as they sign up for Apple's developer program and sign their drivers and get an Apple developer ID and all that sort of thing, that they should even still be able to do that. But I'm not 100% positive on that. Again, because of the sandboxing, there might need to be tighter integration with the operating system, and that could be where the requirement comes into play. So you have an interesting point about the yearly upgrade cycle, but I would imagine Apple's not making as many major changes to the operating system. I mean, Mavericks was a pretty big update, but I mean, even in the core of the operating system, I don't think a whole lot has changed. So I would think that even older drivers may or may not still work. I think a lot of printers didn't break in the last upgrade. But if yours isn't supported, then there may be some other options or some other things that you can look into. I'm not entirely certain, but Apple's operating system, Mac OS X, underlying it has something called the Common Unix Printing System. It's actually a standards-based technology, an open-source printing system developed by Apple for OS X and other Unix operating systems, and it uses the Internet Printing Protocol, IPP, to support both local and network printers. You can actually go to cups.org, and get more information on this. But what it essentially means is, actually, on almost any Mac, if you have the CUPS enabled, the web interface enabled, you can actually access all of the printer controls and the queue and all that stuff from your web browser. So if on a, on your Mac, if you opened up Safari and you went to http://localhost, localhost, 631, which is the port number for your CUPS printer system, and you had the web interface for CUPS turned on, you would see a whole configuration and a thing for setting up and selecting printers and the print queues and all that stuff in a web interface. If you haven't enabled it, and I think most Macs by default don't have the web interface enabled, it will give you instructions on the screen for enabling it. There's a little command you can run in the terminal, CUPS control web interface equals yes. You run that little command and it will actually turn on that web interface. And then you can see it. And so one thing that happens is there's a lot of open source drivers for different printers and scanners and things like that. And at least I haven't tried it in Mavericks, but at least in pre-Mavericks, if you could get a hold of some of these Unix open source CUPS printer drivers, you could install those and those would work within Mac OS X. A lot of times they maybe didn't have as much advanced functionality as the native drivers from the manufacturer, but at least you could get some basic printing and scanning support and stuff like that for older devices and older products that maybe didn't get upgraded officially by the manufacturer. So you might do a little bit of research, a little Googling around, and see if you can find a solution that way. And as much as, you know, I'd love it if Apple had support for every printer and scanner and peripheral out there, I think it's just really not practical. I mean, there's just so many devices and so much technology. And this has happened to me with audio interfaces. I had a great FireWire audio interface from Alesis. It was an IO 14. And for whatever reason, when we did the upgrade to Mountain Lion, they decided that they weren't going to put out new drivers. They promised new drivers for about a year and then never ended up really doing it. So I don't know what the rationale behind it was, but I had to move on. I had to find another audio interface, and that was actually an expensive audio interface. The good news, I think, on printers and scanners and things like that is they're relatively inexpensive, and they get cheaper and cheaper all the time for better and better quality. So I've just found that when I run into something like that, I will just buy a new printer. Now, I know in this case, you've got a highly specialized device, so it's a little bit of an exception, but I have a lot of people who say, you know, I have this printer, I got it for free, it was a $99 printer I got 5 years ago, and now there's no printer drivers on it. It's like, well, you know, you could spend probably $50 and get a better printer than that one now, much better quality, and it will work with your Mac. And I know you have to buy more ink, and people don't like to reinvest in maybe the ink and stuff like that and the consumables, but you're trading off a lot of hassle trying to get something working with drivers that don't quite work. You know, the CUPS drivers are fine, but, you know, it again, you're getting into that fiddly space. So you have to weigh how much time and effort do I want to deal with versus can I just get something new and solve this solution in another way? And I've become, maybe it's my later stage in life, I've become the kind of person where I like the path of least resistance, even if it costs me a little bit more. I'll grumble about it. I don't like paying it. But, you know, at the end of the day, I just kind of like to move on with my life and be able to print. Same sort of thing for scanning. But I do want to mention a couple other solutions. So I'm sharing a little philosophy with you and maybe hopefully some solutions that you can look into to kind of address your problem. But one of the other ways that you can often solve this problem is if you have an older Mac lying around. So I have an old Mac Mini that I actually use for this. It was hooked up to an older printer I had for a while, just serving as a print server. So it was running, I want to say it's running Snow Leopard. And I just turned on the printer sharing. I had this old USB printer hooked up to it. I went into System Preferences, turned on sharing. It had the drivers for it, and just checked on printer sharing. And then I could print to it over my network, and it would print out just fine. And I think I just had to use some generic, you know, print drivers. Again, I didn't have all the advanced features and control, but at least I could send a printout. You could use that sort of thing as a dedicated printer or a dedicated scanning station. For scanners, there's actually a great bit of software that's been around for years called ViewScan. And I use this. I have an old Canon CanoScan. I think it's 670U. I mean, the thing's ancient. It's like from 10 years ago. And the view scan software will still recognize that and allow me to use that scanner with the latest Macs. I haven't tried it on Mavericks, but I'm pretty sure I tried it on Mountain Lion and it worked beautifully. So if you have an older scanner that you just don't want to get rid of, you can give that a try. But once again, you know, I could go out and get a sub-$100 scanner that's going to be 10 times better probably in terms of quality performance than that old CanoScan that I have. So you got to pick your battles and choose your fights and see what you're going to do. But, you know, to kind of go back to your original question, you know, I think that manufacturer just doesn't want to probably have to deal with going through Apple to get their drivers in there. Maybe they don't sell enough of those units. Maybe if it's an older unit and they'd prefer you just to upgrade. I don't know what the rationales might be, but I don't think you've got the full exact story. It's probably something close to that. But I really don't think Apple wants to be writing drivers for every kind of peripheral out there or having to be responsible for that. So I think they should be able to submit something and get those pushed through if they really wanted to. My guess is that they don't have a really big driving force to make that happen. But I could be wrong. And if I am and someone knows differently, if it really is the case that Apple has to write every driver, shoot me an email, let me know, and I'll fully admit that I don't know what I'm talking about. But I did a little research into this and I didn't see anything like that going on. All right, let's talk about one fun thing. This should be great if you're getting this episode before the weekend. This is going to be a great way to spend your weekend. I usually don't make software picks on the MacCast. It's not just something that I typically do, but this actual iOS app is just way too cool for me not to share. I've actually shared it on every podcast that I've been on today, so I'm going to share it with you in case you missed it one of those other places. It's an app from a company called PixelPress, and it's called Floors. And what it allows you to do is it allows you to design and draw your own 2D side-scrolling platformer-style game that you can play on your iPad. But you actually draw out the game on paper. You use pencil and paper to create your whole levels, and then you scan them in with your iPad, and it converts it into an actual playable game. It is really, really cool. It was a Kickstarter that they did about a year ago, and I've been waiting forever for it to come out. And I guess it came out at the end of April, like April 30th, but no one's been talking about it, and I don't know how it hasn't gotten picked up by the press, because I think it's one of the coolest concepts and coolest ideas that I have ever seen. They were funded, and basically what you do is you get the app, you download, they have a PDF with instructions on their website, and there's a little grid template, you know, think like graph paper, and it has three different floors or levels per sheet. So across the bottom of the sheet, it's kind of divided into thirds in the landscape mode. There is a little layout, and you start at the left edge of the screen, and you're going to end up on the right edge, and then once you get to the right edge, you go up to the second level and then to the third level. And there's a little legend, a little symbol, so you don't actually have to, like, draw the game. Don't think like you're drawing characters and you're making elements and stuff like that. What it is you're defining just where the areas are, so where the platforms are, what kind of platforms move, where any obstacles are, where power-ups are going to go, where spikes and hazards and lava pits and all those things are going to go. And you just do that by drawing out blocks. So if you need to, say, for example, put in spikes, you just draw a bunch of X's. Or if you're filling up a lava pit, you draw little slashes in the squares. Or for platforms and stuff like that, you just draw boxes. So you're drawing boxes, you're putting in little pluses and shading out areas and things like that. And based on the legend, that'll define how the gameplay goes, you know. And they define, you know, your character is going to be able to jump up four squares, or if it's doing a running jump, it can jump eight squares. So you kind of know how far to place things on your graph paper. So you draw it all out, and then you open up the app, and you hit the create button, and then you take a picture with the camera. It's got little points that you line up with the camera and a little overlay, and then once it lines up, it will capture it, scan it into the system, and then convert that actually into a wireframe version of your game. And then you can start playtesting it. So you can play it out, make sure that you can reach all the areas that you want to reach, make sure it's not too challenging, or if it's not challenging enough, you can then, within the app itself, go into a little game editor, and it has all the same drawing tools and symbols and stuff like that that you can put in place. So you kind of go back and forth, and you iterate through the whole process, designing out your levels, making sure everything is the way you want. And then after that, you can move into the design mode. And design mode is basically they give you a couple templates. They give you backgrounds. They give you textures that you can apply to your platforms and to your hazards and things like that. And they're themed. They have two themes right now, but they do have plans to expand that out. And I think at some point they also want to open it up so that you'll be able to create your own textures and themes and characters and stuff like that. But you have a set of predefined characters. All the animations are already built in. So you just kind of quickly pick, hey, I want this style for my ramps and my platforms. I want this style for my power-ups. I want this style for my characters. And you wind up with a fully playable 2D slide-scrolling game. It is really amazing. It doesn't take hardly any time at all to do it. You can probably have something built and be playing with it within a matter of 15, 20 minutes. And then you can just iterate on from there. And right now, it supports the iPad 3rd and 4th generation, the iPad Air, and the iPad Mini with Retina display. They're planning on trying to expand support for other devices. That's if you want to use the draw on paper and then, you know, shoot a picture with my camera, do that sort of thing. For the other iPads, for the iPad 2 or the iPad 2nd generation and the iPad Mini without Retina display, you actually can build your levels in the app. So it does have, you know, an in-app system for actually drawing out and building out your levels. So you can still work with it with that. But it is currently iPad only, does not support the iPad 1, and I don't think they have any plans for it. And they're planning on expanding support. I think they're going to bring it to Android, all those sorts of things. And there's also plans for other styles of games. So this first product they're putting out right now is called Floors. It's a side-scrolling platform, you know, 2D platformer, but they are going to bring out a 2D like adventure style game. So think like Zelda or RPG style game, and then also a racing style game, all I think in 2D. And, you know, this is not going to be 3D stuff, but still with the same concept where you draw everything out on paper with paper and pencil and then scan it in. It does also require iOS 7, but they're working on adding in iOS 6 and Android support. And there are a couple of in-app purchase things. The app itself is free right now. So if you are interested in this kind of thing at all, and I think it's great, it's a great project to do if you have kids, right? Because you can kind of teach the whole storytelling and game design process, also the process of doing iterative designs. So, you know, building out one design, play testing it, and then going back and tweaking and modifying it and stuff like that. So there's a lot of good sort of lessons to be learned, I think. And they actually, on their website, have a whole teaching guide for teachers to help integrate this into their classroom and stuff like that. I think it's just, it's really cool. Can you tell I'm excited about it? I've played around with it a little bit. I'm going to be playing around with it, I think, more this weekend, kind of seeing what you can do with it. And I think they just put out a software update. But they do have plans to completely expand it. There's going to be new levels. Oh, I kind of got distracted from telling you about the in-app purchases. So you can buy for 99 cents, you can buy enemies, so you can actually have characters that your characters can battle against in your game, and there's some additional power-ups, which I think cost $1.99. But you don't need to buy any of the add-ons to actually get a lot of value out of the game for free. I think it's free for a limited time. They are going to charge for it at some point. I'm not sure exactly what the price is going to be. So pick it up now while it's free and play around with it, and let me know what you think. And also, you can share your levels once you're done with them. So you can actually, there's a whole play area where you can go in and you can explore levels that other people have created. And I think you can even download them and then tweak them and modify them and play with them. So it's all within app. You can't, I should be very clear, you can't take what you've designed in here and bundle it up and put it into a game you can actually like sell on the App Store. It's just all inside the app itself, but there still is this ability to share and play and create games for your friends and stuff like that. So really, really fun. It's called Floors from Pixel Press. I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. Check it out. But that is going to do it for the episode for this week. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors. Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, also PDF Pen for the iPhone and iOS, as well as Text Expander Touch, and also their newest app for iOS, PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can get more information and details on all of their software over at smilesoftware.com. And Gazelle, it's the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple products are worth by going to gazelle.com. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the show. A big thank you to you for your support, for staying subscribed, for listening. If you have any feedback for me, a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode, you can shoot your emails and your audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline. That's at 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. You can leave voicemail there. You can also leave a voicemail on Skype, and my Skype address is TheMacCast. And if you need links to anything that I talked about in this or any other episode, you'll find those on the website at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And you can find me online between shows. I'm on Twitter, twitter.com/maccast. Also, check out the Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. And we have a Google Plus community over at Google Plus. Just search for MacCast and you'll find it. I'm still hoping someday they'll give me a short URL for that. But for now, just search Google Plus. It's probably the easiest way to find it. But that is going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.